Now, in all the encounters of Karl Marx I talked about, with the young student movement, Karl Runge and the Annals of Halle, his encounter with Feuerbach and his theory of religion, there's one that I have omitted, and that is his encounter of Moses Hess, because in the long run it was probably one of the most important. And the reason is as follows, that Moses Hess was a young Hegelian. He was a leader of these young students at the University of Berlin. But unlike Runge or Feuerbach, Moses Hess was already a socialist. And he already pointed out to the young Hegelians even then after all, socialism might be the way to change society rather than this attack on Christianity, and that the kind of abstraction which we've talked about so much of these young students, or which these young students went in for, that kind of abstractions might be overcome by ideas of socialism and equality. So that modern Marxist scholarship by and large holds that the encounter with Hess was quite crucial because it turned Marx in a kind of socialist direction even before he went to France get his more pragmatic orientation. For in Moses Hess, already from 1840 on onwards, you have the idea of the proletariat, the idea that predominates is the international interests of the proletariat. You have an idea of the necessity of revolution as over philosophy, the necessity of revolution rather than this abstraction philosophy that's attacked also in your reading by Karl Marx later. But the weakness, and you have finally, I'm sorry, the idea of Moses Hess, which becomes crucial, that money is unproductive, that if you abolish money, you will indeed have made a revolution towards equality, towards the equality of the proletariat. And what we call Marx's theory of surplus value is very largely based on Moses Hess's famous essay on money, his essay on money and the unproductivity of money. Indeed, all what I talked about last time, Karl Marx's dislike of the merchants, his belief that commerce is unproductive, all these ideas, you already find in Moses Hess and Moses Hess's article, famous article on money. The weakness in Moses Hess, from Marx's point of view, was his ambivalence towards use of force. He had sort of utopian ideas, which he put forward in his most famous work called The Red Catechism for the German People of 1848, The Red Catechism for the German People. And there he believed that the abolition of money, revolution, would bring about a people's republic. In the people's republic, everyone would be freed from taxes, get credit as much as he wanted, and therefore there would be no difference anymore between the middle classes and the proletariat. Money would be abolished, everybody could get credit, and nobody would have to pay taxes. He also was pessimistic already about ending of war. Military service was an essential part of his People's Republic. He believed that wars would never be abolished. In all of Moses Hess, you have a kind of millenarian, chiliastic tone, which is, of course, quite missing from Marx. Now, Marx's criticism of his former friend, I think, is fairly perceptive. That what is missing from Hess, as it is missing in a sense from the young Hegelians, is a sense of history. That Hess, very much like Weitling and others, have this kind of instant utopia, these schemes, if you like, for utopia, like abolishing taxes, giving credit. But they don't have really a strategy for revolution because they don't have a philosophy of history. Now, that is his criticism against Feuerbach as well, as you will read, and I think it is extremely well taken. Therefore, it is utopian. The same criticism you can make for Bruno Bauer, about whom I talked about, or in France for Proudhon and Fourier. All these kinds of socialists tended, Marx said, I think rightly, towards abstractions, towards generalities, towards utopianism, because they lacked a philosophy of history. And lacking a philosophy of history, they lacked a revolutionary strategy. Marx was borne out in that by the fact that all of these people ended up in the arms of nationalism. Feuerbach, as I have already said to you, the autonomy of man became ever more inner-directed until it becomes a kind of national romanticism. And the same is true with Bruno Bauer. His idea of the autonomy of man, anti-Christianity, is ever more inner-directed until it becomes a romantic nationalism. And the true same is true with Moses Hess. For Moses Hess, of course, becomes rather famous, a forerunner, if you like, of Zionism. In his rather famous work, in his famous work of 1862, which he wrote under the influence, if you like, under the stress of Italian unification, Rome and Jerusalem of 1862 is one of the great basic works in the history of Zionism. But Rome and Jerusalem, he wrote under the influence of Italian unification. And the kind of nationalism Hess has comes from Mazzini, that it is a nationalism which leads to humanity. It isn't the kind of nationalism of Feuerbach and Bauer, a kind of German nationalism, but it is what we call the Mazzinian Italian nationalism of the Italian movement for unification, which always had a cosmopolitan component. Now, what you have, therefore, in spite of all of this, is then that the immediate encounter with Hess was vital for Marx. Now, all of this said, it is clear that Marx never followed the party of his friend. And why, he makes clear in 1844 in his dissertation on Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, where he writes in 1844 already in his dissertation, the head of human emancipation, the head of the emancipation of man must be philosophy, but the heart of this emancipation must be the proletariat. Now, for Ruge and Bruno Bauer, philosophy was first. For Marx, already in Heraclitus, there is a mixture between philosophy and reality. Philosophy and social reality are inexorably mixed. And what that means in practice, again, is that there can be no change without theory. But there can be no theory without the social reality. So that you get this linkage, which is a Hegelian linkage at the basis of Marx, and which later on Lenin and the Bolsheviks and even Engels tore apart, as you will see. This linkage of Marx, only very much later in 1928, Karl Korsch in Germany will write a famous book called Marxism and Philosophy, where he will again advocate this linkage. And for that advocacy, he will be expelled from the German Communist Party. So that you can see that linkage will be ruptured by Engels under the influence of Darwin and science, which will go in later on both to social democracy and to Bolshevism. But immediately, what is important is there is this kind of, if you like to call it, realism, which is of the greatest importance for Marx, a kind of realism that intertwines the two, and a realism that became stronger in France, so that when he came back from France in 1848 to Germany, he had broken completely with the young Hegelians. He had broken completely with that student movement, which had been his political awakening. But he had gone beyond them, if you like, beyond them to his own realization. Now, with that said, we must come to the first problem in his thought, because I told you I would pass to the problems of Marxism. The problem which is particularly connected with the young Marx up to 1859. By and large, 1859 is a kind of watershed. 1859, the publication of the Critique of Political Economy, is a kind of watershed between the young and the old Marx. So we must now come to the problems of the young Marx. Two problems, which I might take in ascending order. And unfortunately, I come to the most important one on Wednesday, when most of you will be already at home. I can't help that, yes? But remember, Marx is more important than Skokie or Shorewood or wherever you're going. Remember that, yes? There are two problems which now confront us with the young Marx. First, the problem of alienation and the meaning of alienation, which I want to take up today. And secondly, the more fundamental problem, in a sense, Marx and human nature and the essence of man, which I want to take up on Wednesday. Now, it is clear from what I've said that the concern with alienation of man from society, he has in common, of course, with almost all the theories we have discussed. It is built into the Industrial Revolution. It is built in to the industrialization of Europe. But Marx deals with that mostly in his early works, in the works of his youth, because it came to him more or less directly from Hegel, who you remember had dealt with it. And he deals with it in the clearest sense in something that was never published and something that was only discovered in 1925, namely his so-called economic and philosophical manuscripts. The economic and philosophical manuscripts Karl Marx wrote in 1844, they were then lost and not really recovered till 1925. And here Marx concentrates, perhaps in the clearest manner, upon the point that man is indeed alienated from the society in which he lives, and that his alienation is due to what Marx calls alienated labor. Now, alienation for Marx means, as it did for Hegel, externalization. The product of labor is something external to you. It is something independent, outside yourself. It becomes a thing, really, an object, not with any kind of relation to your own human essence. Your labor is detached from you, or you would say in German, you have no inner relationship to your labor. You have no real relationship to your labor. It is externalized. It is externalized. And that Marx calls eventually a kind of fetishism. It is externalized. Everything you do with your labor becomes an object. Yes? And nothing really that is connected anymore to what we might call the essence of man. And that at the same time, this means estrangement from society. And because labor is externalized, man is alienated from society. But Marx goes one step further. Because he was a Victorian, because he believed that labor was at the center and that labor was all important, because he believed in the gospel of work, he believed as labor becomes externalized, man himself becomes externalized. As the product of your labor is a thing, you yourself become a thing. Or to put it in modern terms, dehumanized. As your labor is dehumanized, you yourself are dehumanized. But it goes further than that. You are no longer a man, you really become a kind of thing. For labor doesn't really mean only work as it means today. The word labor has changed. But in Marx's day, deriving from John Locke, labor was really a word denoting something much larger than just what we denote. We denote by labor really production, what we produce, either with our pen or with our hands. And I'll come back to that. We make a distinction automatically, which Marx would say is a sign of our alienation, between ourselves and what we produce. We make an automatic distinction. So that through industrialization, Marx is quite correct, labor and man have become detached. You make an automatic distinction between work, and I'll come back to that because Marx has quite a lot to say about that, between work and vocation. You make a distinction between work and life. Well, by and large, John Locke and before industrialization, no such distinction was made. And I know it's difficult for you to understand, but you must understand that work and life, largely through the Protestant ethic, but not only, was in a way fused. Work and life was fused, yes? Labor was the self-expression of man, the expression of man in his physical and mental power. Now, this, of course, in industrialism is impossible. You work in an assembly line. That cannot be very well the expression of your physical and mental power, because there is no physical and mental power involved. It is automatic work, yes? So this automatic work in industrialization has changed the whole concept of labor. At the time of John Locke and before industrialization, labor was built into your life, whether you were a peasant or a craftsman. Labor was built into your life. You could identify yourself with what you did, whether it was the harvest or whatever you crafted. You could identify yourself with what you did, obviously. It was, in a sense, an expression of your physical and mental labor. But an assembly line, you cannot identify yourself with. An industrial worker cannot identify himself with what is purely automatic work, mass production. Makes the difference. Mass production makes the difference. And thus the whole concept of labor, Marx is quite right on that, has changed. Marx's central critique of capitalism, therefore, was a totally, we would say, logical and understandable and proper one, which I think we would now all accept, namely that capitalism perverts labor into what Marx calls forced, meaningless, alienated labor. Forced, meaningless, alienated labor. And the way he puts it in the philosophical and economic manuscripts is worth recalling at some length, because he puts it, I think, better than it could be put at all, or I could put it in my own words. This is what he writes. What constitutes, he asks, the alienation of labor? First, that the work is external to the worker, that it is not part of his nature, and that consequently he does not fulfill himself in his work, but denies himself, has a feeling of misery rather than of well-being, does not develop freely his mental and physical energies, but is physically exhausted and mentally debased. The worker therefore feels himself at home only during his leisure time, whereas at work he feels homeless. And that is why Marx has no theory of leisure, because meaningful work to Marx does not need leisure. Meaningful work does not need leisure. Typically Victorian idea that leisure is only necessary in a world of meaningless work. It's only necessary in a world where you divide work from life. His work is not voluntary, but imposed, forced labor. It is not the satisfaction of a need, but only the means of satisfying others' need. So it's doubly alienated. It's alienated through the process of mass production. And as unlike the peasant and the craftsman, you don't produce for your own need, but you produce for other people's needs. So it is, in a way, doubly alienated here. Its alien character is clearly shown by the fact that as there is no physical or other compulsion, it is avoided like the plague. Now, Marx sums this up, the results, as follows. We arrive at the result that the worker feels himself to be freely active only in his animal functions, eating, drinking, and procreating. There is in Marx always this Puritanism about everything. In this, he was too a child of his time. Eating, drinking, and procreating. Only free in his animal function. Well, this is, of course, totally true. If you've ever been to Grossinger's or some other resort area, yes, that's what you do in leisure time, or Miami Beach, or wherever you go. I don't. Well, I can't eat anymore. I'm on a diet. I can't drink, and procreation, that's none of your business. So we arrive at the result that man feels himself to be freely active only in his animal functions, eating, drinking, and procreation, or at most also in his dwelling and personal adornment, while in his human functions he is reduced to an animal. The animal becomes human, and the human becomes animal. Now that is the result of all of this, of alienated labor, of alienated labor. Alienation, therefore, is defined here quite different from some other theories which have concerned us. It is not alienation from the folk, alienation from the nation, which is, after all, Hegel eventually. Alienation from the state, from the folk, from the nation. Nor is it alienation because with de Tocqueville, there is no spirit of government. That is alienation because you don't freely participate in government. It isn't at all a political concept of alienation. But it is a concept that really goes back to the Enlightenment, that stresses the fundamental thing of human nature and of the dignity of the individual, which will be central to socialism until Bolshevism, the dignity of the individual and the human essence. Man is alienated from his human essence. And you come to something that I want to come back to later at more length. For Marx, the human essence is basic, because otherwise there would be nothing you could be alienated from. And so you must never make the mistake in believing that man is what he eats for Marx, or that man is merely a creature of the means of production. That would be entirely nonsensical. For Marx is still an 18th century figure. Marx is essentially still an Enlightenment figure. His idea is still the Enlightenment, the human essence. But his idea of alienation also then comes from concrete and observable fact, from the fact of labor. Now, what this means for Marx is that man's very life process, the human reality of existence, must be re-examined. This isn't something abstract that is involved here in man recapturing himself. It is not something abstract, but something concrete. And what man has to recapture is his entire life process, but especially, of course, his life process at work. You will read this, and this will be the essence of your reading, I think. It'll help you if I say this. In the German ideology. For much of the German ideology returns to the idea of the, which I just mentioned, to the idea of the division of labor, to that idea of division of labor. And here comes one of the most famous sentences of Marx. Consciousness can never be anything else. This is in your reading. Consciousness can never be anything else than conscious existence. And the existence of men is their actual life process. Therefore, consciousness is not national consciousness. It isn't longing to be in a community of affinity or national community or community with nature or all the other things that you've studied as an end to alienation. Community with nature, community with the nation, the idea of ending alienation by joining a kind of community of affinity. That won't do, because consciousness is consciousness of existence. And what is existence? Existence is life process. And what is your life process? Your life process is your labor. It's defined by your labor, by what you do, by what you do. And you get here again the interplay about what you do and what you think. It's very Hegelian in this way. The reality and consciousness interplay, but they don't interplay in the Hegelian way, that there is the idea of freedom, an abstraction, which tries to push through all the time, yes? That isn't here, for the idea of freedom, alienated labor is really substituted. What for Hegel is the basic idea of freedom, which pushes through, it is the idea of alienated labor, which is important here and put in the center. And once you get rid of that, then the human essence can unfold. This is again, if you like, a Hegelian idea. Now, This is the materialism involved in Marx. Let me summarize it. The materialism involved in Marx, then, is that consciousness can only be conscious of existing reality. That reality in which man lives and which is determined by his labor, his social relationships, if you like. That the task of man is therefore to free man's life process, that is his labor, from enslaving him. And thereby man becomes human. Thereby man becomes human. For at the moment, labor is something outside of himself. He is the tool of its force and not the active agent of the life process. The end of alienation means really the recapture of your own domination over your own life. That is what Marx means when he describes the classless society of hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon. What this is a metaphor for is that man must dominate. Man must dominate over his own life, and as you will see eventually, over nature as well. The theory of Marxism is a theory of domination, but it is a theory of domination by which man recaptures his own essence. It is that kind of theory of domination. Man's alienation, then, is total under capitalism. And here again we are back with Hegel. Man's consciousness is alienated from himself as well. As Marx put it, under capitalism, man cannot even appreciate the most beautiful spectacle. And here Marx's example is aesthetics. Man is so alienated, he has lost every aesthetic sense. And Marx was very keen on that. He was a great admirer of Shakespeare, above all of Balzac with his social novels. Balzac was his famous novelist, and Shakespeare. He was a cultured German, and therefore culture was to him, Bildung, which I talked to him, to Marx, all important. And in the last resort, when he wants to explain how alienated you are, he always comes back to the old ideas of building. You can't be a cultured person anymore. It's that bad under capitalism. You've lost your aesthetic sense. All is obscured by the alienation of the life process. And all is obscured by money. Everything becomes a thing, the fetishism of God. Everything becomes the cash nexus. And here comes Marx's most famous example, of course. The dealer in minerals sees their only commercial, the dealer in minerals sees only their commercial value, not their beauty. In other words, there is no more beauty in this world because everything is commercialized. Now, of course, that's quite true. You only have to look at television advertisements to know that that's utterly true analysis. Everything is commercialized. There is no more beauty in this world. In the United States, what there is of beauty in television is wedged between advertisements. So that everything is commercialized. And for Marx, this means the fetishism of goods. This means that everything has become a thing, that everything has become cash value. So, of course, quite true today. People don't buy art anymore, as you know, to hang on their walls. People buy art as an investment. Well, that even Marx didn't yet foresee. That's a development of today's capitalism, yes? But it is, of course, totally true that people buy these things. And if you have art in your house, as I have, you'd be surprised how many people come to my house and say, that's a good investment. You know? I mean, completely alienated friends I have, friends who are completely alienated. I'm not kidding. Yes, they are. I mean, all the pressure is, it's a very shrewd analysis. That's a very shrewd analysis at the moment, as far as we're going now. It's a very shrewd analysis. And that is one reason, by the way, one reason why the young Marx has remained alive and the old Marx hasn't. That's one reason why in 1918 the young Marx was revived by Lukács and Korsch and others, and why the young Marx was revived by the Frankfurt School in Germany and so on in the great Marxist revival, and why it is today that the young Marx is really the object of interest and the object of hope, and not the older Marx, who already shades over into Engels, into determinism, into what will be Bolshevism, because of this analysis and the analysis. Because this is what Herbert Marcuse means when he talks about the alienation. He talks about the deprivation of reality. Herbert Marcuse in One Dimensional Man, which you may have read, always talks about you are deprived of reality because you can no longer see reality because you're too alienated. The criticism, of course, is this, that Marx was too obsessed with the industrial proletariat. That, of course, is obvious. This whole theory is based on the assembly line, yes? For many others, labor is never alienated. Labor, that's clear. It's all based on the assembly line. It's all based on Manchester, about which Engels was sending him constantly information, yes? It's all based on Manchester, this theory, yes? On industrialized Manchester. But it is obviously not based on most of the profession that the bourgeoisie enters. This is clear, because, of course, for that, many of these professions aren't alienated labor at all. This is clear, too. Now, what I must emphasize here, that for Marx, reality was obviously a social reality. Social reality. And you can now understand the famous passage from the Communist Manifesto of 1848. The famous passage from the Communist Manifesto in which Marx mocks what he calls the alienation from humanity. This isn't alienation from humanity in general. This is alienation from yourself in particular and from social life, real life processes. So that on the one sense, Marx is more individualist than Bruno Bauer and the others. And in another sense, of course, it is a kind of realism. And yet, of course, there must be here a kind of tension between individualism and determinism. There is a tension between the individualism which lies at the back of this whole analysis and Marx's theory of history, which is, after all, determinist theory of history taken from Hegel. There is a dialectic. Feudalism does give, we'll talk about that later, does give way to the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie will give way to feudalism. In other words, there is from the beginning a tension between the Enlightenment and the theory of history, between Marx's individualism and Marx's determinist theory of history. That, I think, is without doubt. But remember one other thing. Marx never uses the term historical materialism. That term is Engels' term, not Marx's term. Marx calls it genuine materialism to distinguish it from scientific materialism. Marx was very ambivalent about that. History was determinate, but he didn't liken it to a science. He was very careful to distinguish his kind of tension between individualism and the workings of history from what Engels later called scientific materialism. was very careful to make that kind of distinction. Yes? Just as there is another tension here, quite clearly, which I must mention now, the tension between the fact that what governs alienated labor is the means of production, and that to end alienation, you must end the means of production. That is clear. You must change the means of production. But on the other hand, his belief in an innate creativity of man, his belief that man is innately creative, his, I believe, in other words, in that kind of human essence again. And yet, the tensions in Marx he tried to resolve by looking at history and life and alienation not as something static, but as a process. Now, a process that was, like Hegel, in many ways open-ended. Now, the great difference between Lenin and Marxism, between Leninism and Marxism, is that Leninism is static and Marxism is not. Because Marxism is based on Hegel. And Leninism is based, in other words, on an end to history, on the ideal society. Not that history is a continuous process, which would, of course, would do communist society today in. It would destroy them, because they would only be a stage to a higher form, yes? And that, of course, won't do at all. So, in other words, what really happened in the development of Marxism when it became Leninism? Hegel was taken out of it. Hegel was taken out of it. And once you take Hegel out of it, you get a kind of dumb or stur materialism. You get an idea that the dictatorship of the proletariat is the end and not the beginning. Yes? You get a static element, which Marx opposed, because to Marx, history was a process. History was a process. And revolution was built in, if you like, and as you will see, to what you might call the process of history, a continual process. Reality evolves. Reality evolves. Otherwise, his theory would not hold at all. What then about the class structure? What is the relation of alienation to the class structure? Obviously, alienated labor is an essential part of the class structure. The individual is not today a person, but he is a member of a class. Class is identical with alienation. Now remember, sometimes when you hear modern-day Marxists, you think class is a good thing. Class is, of course, a bad thing. It has to be abolished. And it is part of the sign of the alienation of labor, that you are not yourself. You're a member of a class, the bourgeoisie, the proletariat, whatever class, the feudal class. You're a member of a class that's part of the product of the process of production, result of the process of production. The result, you are a class individual. The abolition of classes is then at the basis. But again, it is not static, as you will see, but obviously a process. Now, Marx spent a lifetime elaborating what he thought then was at the basis, how man could recover his individuality, not through community, but through an abolition of class. And as that is so, Marx spent a lifetime investigating what is class. What is a class? What is it? Yes? And his result is famous. It ties in with his philosophy of history. While the interests of every class are one-sided, the interest of the proletariat is not. And therefore, the best hope for today is the proletariat, because it is the one class which transcends class. In other words, feudalism, the bourgeoisie, historically, have acted according to their class interests, acted according to their control of the means of production. The bourgeoisie overthrew the feudalism, and now the bourgeoisie is acting as a class in a defensive position. This is, in a way, Hegel's dialectic. But why did he think the proletariat was different? Because they had no property. It was the first time, he said, in history, that a class has no property and no chance of acquiring property. Again, he looked at Manchester. He looked at this industrial labor in Manchester. Therefore, the proletariat, is a class which transcends class. It has no property or profit to defend. Its interests, therefore, are quite different. Its interests are the overthrow of property. Its interests are, for the first time, different. Feudalism had property to defend. The bourgeoisie has property to defend. Proletarian doesn't have property to defend. Now, you may say they were always poor. What about poor peasants and things like that? Well, Marx would say, the difference is the proletariat is organized. And here's the hope. It is something that can be organized. While before that, these were chiliastic and millenarian movements which you could never organize. But the proletariat, you could organize. And therefore, you could maximize or use the fact, if you like, that its interest was in the overthrow of property to overthrow property. So that you get the proletariat, obviously, as the revolutionary class. But you must go one step further. Because that is so, the proletariat is the custodian of humanity. Marx didn't believe that the worker was the individual worker was the custodian of humanity. Marx had no romanticism, worker romanticism. When I was a young socialist, when I was a young communist in my youth and taught at the California Labor School in San Francisco, things like that, we had that great romanticism. We went down to the factory. We wanted to be a worker. But there's none of that in Marx at all. He never thought of that, of course. Neither did Engels. Engels could have been a worker. Because that's really quite contrary to Marxism, this romanticism about the worker. That's a later thing. And not by the workers themselves, but by the bourgeoisie, of course. This romanticism about the worker. The proletariat is the custodian of humanity because it is the one class that can bring humanity about. And it's a custodian of humanity only if it gets organized and if it becomes a revolutionary force. Not because of the wonderful greatness of the individual worker. After all, that comes later. That comes in Mexico with these famous murals of the Mexican communist painters. That great idea that then in the Soviet Union and Cuba, the great worker, yes? Worker loves tractor, tractor loves worker, that sort of thing. That was never in Marx's idea. That was never in Marx's idea. That sort of thing that was propagated above all, I think, by Mexican art, by the great Mexican artists, communist artists then eventually. And Lenin, of course, rightly denounced what he called the romanticism about the proletariat. That didn't fit into Lenin's scheme either. But it came about, nevertheless, of course. I remember very vividly my thrill when I first worked for 2 days. I couldn't stand it for more in a factory, which was my proletarian gesture. But that's more than any of you've done, I'm sure. Well, we'll go next time.